if you might be able to look into two old cases for me. I believe you might also find them interesting, and I hope you understand that I wouldn't ask were it not that the situation in which we find ourselves requires it. Dots indicate there is a part three. Chris and Donna have recently been in to see the chief constable of Kent, a man named Andrew Everton. Good copper, sticks up for his troops, but merciless if anyone crosses the line. He writes novels in his spare time, too, under a pen name. The chief constable publishes the books himself, and you can get them only on Kindle. Another officer was telling Chris that's where the real money is these days, but Andrew Everton still drives an old Vauxhall Vectra, so it may not be true. Andrew Everton told them they are both going to get a commendation at the Kent Police Awards for their work catching Connie Johnson. Nice to get a bit of recognition. The walls of the chief constable's office were garlanded with portraits of proud police officers, heroes all. Chris looks at this sort of thing through Donna's and Patrice's eyes these days, and had noticed the portraits were all of men save for one of a woman and one of a police dog. The police dog had a medal. Chris sees a used condom curled up in a seashell. Life is a miracle. Another text from Ibrahim, cutting to the chase, hopefully. The cases to which I referred in my previous message are the death of Bethany Waits and the conviction of Heather Garbutt for fraud, both from 2013, with particular emphasis on where Bethany Waits might have been between 10:15 p.m. and 2:47 a.m. on the night of her death, and who might have been in her car with her. All information gratefully received. Talk soon, my good friend. Love to Patrice. You really have found yourself a fine woman there. Often, in relationships, the key is to... Chris stops reading. He remembers both cases, Bethany Waits and Heather Garbutt. Will he take a look? Who is he kidding? Of course he will take a look. One day the Thursday Murder Club will get him sacked or possibly killed, but it's worth the risk. He feels as if someone must have conjured them up just for him, to save him. The Thursday Murder Club brought him Donna. Donna brought him Patrice. Patrice brought him stir-fried tofu. And all of that, it turns out, brought him happiness. Donna looks up from her phone. Why are you smiling? Chris shrugs. Why are you smiling? Donna shrugs. You getting texts from my mum? Can't open those in public, says Chris. Vice Squad will pull me in. Donna sticks out her tongue. Ibrahim wants us to look into a case. Don't tell me, says Donna. Someone called Bethany drove her car off a cliff. How on earth would you... Donna waves this away. Chris looks out to sea and Donna joins him. The grey clouds are turning an angry black and the whipping wind lashes their faces with stinging salt spray. The smell of burnt metal and plastic from the minibus mixes with the stench of the decaying corpse and catches in their throats. Two seagulls fight loudly and angrily over a plastic shopping bag. So beautiful, says Chris. Stunning, agrees Donna. Chapter 8. Elizabeth has been thinking about the CCTV cameras. How on earth did they not pick up Bethany's car as she drove through Fairhaven? Before leaving for her walk, she had rung Chris about it, and he had said, Ah, I've been expecting you. She asked if he might have a look into it, and he said he was rather busy with a corpse of his own, so Elizabeth had congratulated him on the commendation he had just received from the chief constable and reminded him of her part in catching Connie Johnson for him. So he has agreed to take a look. Elizabeth and Stephen have started taking a walk at the same time each afternoon. rain or shine. Same route, same time. They walk through woods along the western wall of the graveyard, where Elizabeth had gone digging not so very long ago, and out into the open fields beyond the new buildings, which are beginning to spring up on top of the hill. There they stop, take out a hip flask, and talk to the cows. Stephen has given all the cows their own names and personalities, and every day gives Elizabeth a running commentary of all the latest cow developments. Today, Stephen tells her that Daisy has been cheating on Brian with Edward, a younger, more handsome bull from a nearby field, and Daisy and Brian are now trying cow counselling. Elizabeth takes a nip of whiskey and says that Daisy is an unimaginative name for a cow. "No dispute there," agrees Stephen. "The blame lies squarely with her mother, also called Daisy." "Is that so?" says Elizabeth. "And what was her father called?"
No one knows, that's the thing," says Stephen. "Quite the scandal at the time. Daisy Senior had been on holiday to Spain, rumours of a fling."
"Hmm," says Elizabeth.
"In fact, if you listen closely, you can hear Daisy has just the slightest hint of a Spanish accent."
Daisy moves as if on cue and they both laugh. It is time now, though, to head back through the woods, along the path that she has made herself quiet, private, all their own. Keeping Stephen away from prying eyes, away from inconvenient questions about the state of his mind. Their hands stay clasped together as they walk, arms lightly swinging, hearts beating as one. This routine has quickly become Elizabeth's favourite time of the day. Her handsome, happy husband, she can pretend for a little while longer that all is well, that his hand will forever be in hers. "Nice day for a walk," says Stephen, the sun lighting up his face. "We should do this more often." "God willing," thinks Elizabeth, "and I will take every walk with you that I can." Bethany's body had never been found. That worries Elizabeth. She has read enough detective novels to know you must never trust a murder without a corpse. To be fair, she has also faked a number of deaths herself over the years. Her attention elsewhere, Elizabeth sees the man only for a split second, but she instantly realizes she has made a mistake. It happens, not often, but it happens. This happy routine of hers, these familiar walks with Stephen, this familiar pleasure was, of course, Elizabeth's big mistake, as love so often is. Routine is the spy's greatest enemy. Never travel the same route 2 days in a row. Never leave work at the same time. Don't eat in the same restaurant every Friday evening. Routine gives your enemy an opportunity to plan ahead, an opportunity to hide, an opportunity to pounce. Her split second is up. Her last thought is, please don't hit Stephen. She doesn't even feel the blow she knows is coming. Chapter 9. And then, in the late 70s, I went out with a member of UB40, but I think we all did back then, says Pauline.
Which one? Asked Ron, trying to eat his soup with a little decorum.
Pauline shrugs. There were so many of them, I think. I slept with one of Madness, too. Or he said he was, at least.
Ron had rung his son, Jason, and asked where might be good for lunch. Somewhere that was classy, but wouldn't make a fuss if he didn't know what knife to use. Somewhere that did food he would recognise, but would have proper napkins and nice loos. Somewhere you didn't have to wear a tie, but you could if you wanted. Just hypothetical, say. But remember, he was a pensioner, not made of money. Though, you know, he had a few bob put away. Don't you worry about that.
Jason had listened politely, then said, And what's her name?
Ron had said, Whose name?
Jason had said, Your date.
And Ron had said, What makes you think?
And Jason had said, Le Pont Noir, Dad, she'll love it. And Ron had said, Pauline. And Jason wished him the best of luck.
Then they spoke about West Ham for a bit, until Ron asked Jason if he could book the restaurant for him, because he could never work out websites and was too shy to ask Ibrahim to do it for him.
"Your mate really going to Darwell Prison today?" Pauline asks.
"We have a habit of interfering," says Ron. "So what's your take on this Bethany Waits thing? You were around at the time."
Le Pont Noir is what they call a gastropub. Ron had to scan the whole menu twice before he saw there was a steak. Even then, it said bavette of steak, but it came with chips, so he was hoping it was going to be safe.
"She was a terrier, that's for sure," says Pauline. "In a good way. Mike was very cut up when she died. They looked out for each other, rare in this business."
"A looker too," says Ron, "if you like blondes, which I don't, not my type. Not that I have a type, I'm not fussy. Well, I'm fussy, but..."
Pauline puts a finger to Ron's lips to help him out of his cul-de-sac of a sentence. He nods gratefully.
"She'd just started dating a new fella too," says Pauline.
"Some cameraman, as always. In telly, the women all date their cameramen, and the men all date their makeup artists."
"Oh, really?" says Ron, eyebrow raised. "So you and Mike Waghorn, you ever..."
Pauline laughs. "You've no worries there, darling. Mike dates cameramen too."
"There go Joyce's chances," says Ron, as his bavette of steak arrives.
He is mightily relieved to see it is just a normal steak that someone has already cut up for him. Bingo.
"You reckon the story got her killed?"
Pauline is pretending to look enthusiastic about a dish of braised cauliflower that has just been put in front of her.
"Maybe," she says. "Let's talk about something else. I get enough of this from Mike."
Ron is trying to work out who Pauline looks like. A bit Liz Taylor, maybe. The new head judge on Strictly. He has decided on reflection that she is definitely out of his league. And yet here she was.
"How's your cauliflower?"
"Take a wild guess," Ron smiles. "You enjoy yourself last night then?" says Pauline.
Ron had stayed over at hers for the first time. If you can eat braised cauliflower suggestively, then that's what she's doing. Ron feels his cheeks flush.
It's been a while for me, so maybe I'm not what you're used to. It's been a long time. It was nice just staying up talking. I hope that was okay."
"Lover, it's been a long time for me too," says Pauline. "It was perfect. You're a gent, and a handsome, funny gent at that. Let's just go at our own pace, shall we?"
Ron nods and eats some more of his steak. They haven't brought any ketchup, but other than that, he couldn't fault the Pont Noir at all. "Thank you, Jace."
"You fancy a walk along the front after this," says Pauline, "while the sun's still in the sky. Get an ice cream on the pier."
Ron thinks about his knees. How much they hurt when he doesn't use that blasted stick Jason bought for him. How they make him feel like an old man. Every step will hurt, all the more so, for hiding it from Pauline. He'll be laid up in bed all day tomorrow.
"I'd love to," says Ron. "I'd love to."
Perhaps he doesn't need to hide anything from Pauline.
"And I know your knee gives you jip," says Pauline, "so let's get you a stick, for goodness sake. I don't need a tough guy slowing me down. I just want an ice cream and a kiss from Ron Ritchie on the pier."
Ron smiles again. He still won't be using a stick. He's got standards. But it's nice to hear. Pauline gestures to her bag. "I've got a couple of spliffs in here too. They'll help."
Chapter 10. How long has Elizabeth been unconscious? Impossible to tell. So what does she know? She is lying on the cold metal floor of a speeding vehicle. Her hands are cuffed behind her, and her feet are bound,
A blindfold covers her eyes, and white noise is being played at deafening volume through a pair of headphones, a familiar torture technique. But on the plus side, she is not dead, which at least gives her options. All she can control right now is her breathing, and so she does just that. Slow, deep, and steady. Nothing to be gained by panicking. She suspects she's going to need all her energy when she finally discovers where she's being taken. Would they have hit Stephen too? Or not seen the need? Is he here with her? Elizabeth wriggles backwards across the floor of the vehicle. She has now deduced it must be a van, until she brushes up against another body. They are back to back. She knows it is Stephen. She can tell by the electricity. With her hands behind her back, she feels for his hands. He is doing the same, and their hands clasp like those of sleepy waking lovers. She squeezes Stephen's hand, then worries that that is perhaps emasculating. Should he be squeezing her hand? In the circumstances, it is probably right that she is being the reassuring presence. Stephen has not been in this sort of position before. She puts her finger on his wrist in what could easily be a sign of affection, but really she is checking his pulse. She is seeing if he is panicking. His pulse is rock steady, 65 beats per minute. Of course it is. Stephen will also be controlling his breathing, trusting that his wife will get him out of this. But will she? Well, it very much depends on what this is, Elizabeth supposes. It's the man sending her the text, certainly. Finally made good in his threats, but who is it? And what job does he have for her? The van is beginning to slow down, as if it has left a major road and joined a minor one. Elizabeth takes note. She will be missed in Cooper's chase, that's a good thing. Joyce will spot that her light is not on this evening, or will she? Will she be busy looking into Heather Garbutt? Will Ibrahim be thinking about Connie Johnson? Will Ron be busy with... Well, that goes without saying. Will they even notice her absence? Will they raise the alarm? Elizabeth knows she is already too far from home anyway. There will be no cavalry to save her this time. She has got herself into this mess, and she will have to get herself out of it. The van comes to a halt. Elizabeth waits and breathes. She feels a hand on her shoulder, roughly dragging her up. But whose hand? Chapter 11.
So, you're not from the Sunday Times? Asks Connie Johnson, not unreasonably, in Ibrahim's view. She is chewing gum. Again, fine by Ibrahim, good for dental health so long as it is sugar-free. No, I lied, says Ibrahim, crossing his legs, then tugging down the hem of his trouser leg. I thought you might be more likely to speak to me if you thought I was a journalist.
They are sitting in a visiting room at Darwell Prison. Tables are spread out, but close enough that everyone can hear everyone else's heartbreak if they choose to. Ibrahim is listening to every conversation while conducting his own with Connie. That is his habit.
Then who are you? Asks Connie.
She is in a prison jumpsuit, but is surprisingly well made up for someone with no obvious access to high-end cosmetics.
My name is Ibrahim Arif. I'm a psychiatrist.
Well, that's fun, says Connie, and she sounds like she means it. Who sent you? Prosecution lawyer? See if I'm batshit?
I already know you're not batshit, Connie. You are a very controlled, intelligent, motivated woman.
Connie nods.
I'm very goal-oriented. I scored 96 on a Facebook quiz about it. That's a nice suit. Someone's doing all right?
You set goals, Connie, and then you achieve those goals. Am I right?
I do,
said Connie, then looks around her. Though I am in prison, aren't I, Ibrahim Arif, so I'm not perfect.
Who among us is? Asks Ibrahim. It is healthy to admit that to ourselves. I wonder if you might like a task, Connie.
A task?
You need coke? You don't look like you need coke. You want someone murdered? You look like you could afford it.
Nothing illegal at all, says Ibrahim. He absolutely loves talking to criminals. He can't deny it. It's the same with famous people, too. He loved talking to Mike Waghorn.
Quite the opposite. The opposite of illegal.
Okay, and what's in it for me?
For you, nothing at all, says Ibrahim. I just suspect it's something you'd be rather good at, and therefore you'd rather enjoy.
I mean, I'm quite busy, says Connie, smiling.
I see that, says Ibrahim, smiling back. Connie's smile looks real, and so his is real in return.
Okay, what's the task, says Connie. I like your cheek, and I like your suit. Let's talk business.
Ibrahim quietens a little, keeps his voice flat and under the radar.
There's an inmate here, called Heather Garbutt. Do you know her?
Is she the Pevensey Strangler?
I don't think so, no, says Ibrahim.
There's a Heather on D Wing, says Connie. Older, looks clever, like a teacher who robbed a bank.
Let's assume that's her for now, says Ibrahim. Do you think you could befriend her, perhaps find something out for me?
Sounds like the sort of thing I could do, says Connie.
Ibrahim can already see her mind is in motion.
What do you need to find out?
I need to find out if she murdered a television reporter called Bethany Waits in 2013 by pushing her car over a cliff.
Cool, says Connie, a small grin creeping onto her face. I'll just ask her. Nice cup of tea. Isn't it mild for this time of year? And did you murder someone?
Well, I'll leave it up to you how you approach the question, says Ibrahim. Your area, not mine, and maybe she didn't do it. That would also be useful information.
I bet she did, though, says Connie. I've never pushed a car off a cliff, always wanted to.
Ibrahim raises his palms. There's still time, I'm sure.
And there's really nothing in it for me, asks Connie. You can't smuggle in a SIM card for me or something?
I don't think I could, says Ibrahim. I could Google how to do it, though, and give it a go.
Don't stress. I've got plenty, and you don't want to know how they get smuggled in.
Ibrahim thinks he will Google it anyway. He is really enjoying himself. He hasn't been out much since his mugging, but bit by bit, he is regaining his confidence, and bit by bit, he's feeling his old self return.
There are scars, yes.
But that at least means the bleeding has stopped. And it's nice to remember he's good at this sort of thing, at reading people, at understanding trouble and redirecting it. He likes Connie and she likes him, although one has to be careful. She is a ruthless killer, and without wishing to be judgmental about it, that is fairly bad. He will have good news to report back to the gang later, though. He starts thinking about SIM cards. They are very small, Ibrahim knows that, so he wonders how you... Ibrahim realizes that Connie has just said something and that he has missed it. That is unlike him, very unlike him. Time to sharpen up.
I'm sorry, says Ibrahim, I didn't catch that.
You are off in dreamland, Ibrahim, says Connie. Let me ask you again. As a psychiatrist, what do you think motivates me?
This is easy meat for Ibrahim. Sure, we are all different, all unique snowflakes leading unique lives, but we are all the same under the bonnet.
Momentum, I would say. A desire for movement and change.
Ibrahim steeples his fingers. Some people need everything to stay the same. I am a little like that. If they change the music on the shipping forecast, for example, I would hyperventilate. But some people need everything to change. You need everything to change. That chaos is where you're able to hide yourself.
Hmm, says Connie. How wise, Mr. Ibrahim Arif. But do you think honesty is important to me?
Where's this going? Ibrahim has a sinking feeling. I imagine so. In your line of work, honesty is, ironically, paramount.
You imagine so, do you? Asks Connie. Where did you get my name, mate? How did you hear about Connie Johnson? Who sent you?
A client, says Ibrahim. He is a bad liar and tries to avoid lies whenever he can, but he's had to lie more and more often since he met Elizabeth, Joyce and Ron.
Because I've heard your name before, says Connie.
Ibrahim Arif. Do you know where I heard that name?
Ibrahim is all out of lies as Connie leans over and whispers in his ear. From your mate, Ron Ritchie, the day I got arrested. She settles back in her chair. Your move, Ibrahim.
He told you to come here, didn't he? Asks Connie. You're working for him.
No, I'm working for Elizabeth Best of MI5 or MI6, one of them.
Connie takes us in. So, MI5 or 6 want me to talk to Heather Garbutt?
Indirectly, yes, says Ibrahim.
And will this help me in court? Can a gang of men in balaclavas bust me out of the dock?
No, I'm afraid not, says Ibrahim, though it occurs to him that they probably could. Elizabeth would know. Best not to promise anything.
Ibrahim, says Connie, I don't like being lied to.
No, says Ibrahim, I apologize.
And, continues Connie, it's important that you know that the moment I'm out, I'm going to kill your friend Ron Ritchie for landing me in here.
Noted.
Connie thinks for a moment. And do you know Bogdan?
I do, admits Ibrahim.
I'm going to kill him too. Will you tell them both for me?
I will pass on the message, yes.
Is Bogdan seeing anyone, do you know?
I don't think so, says Ibrahim.
Connie nods. A prison warder approaches the table. Time's up, Johnson. That's your 20. Connie turns to him. 5 more minutes. You don't run this jail, says the warder. We do. 5 more minutes and I'll get your son an iPhone, says Connie. The warder thinks for a moment. 10 minutes and he wants an iPad.
Thank you, officer, says Connie, and turns back to Ibrahim.
I'm so bored here, let's do it. Give me everything you've got on Heather Garbutt. I'm still going to kill your friends, but until that happens, let's all agree to get along and have a bit of fun.
Ibrahim nods. You know, you could just choose not to kill my friends, Connie.
How do you mean? Asks Connie, genuinely confused.
All that happened here is that they outsmarted you.
Is that such a bad thing?
They took advantage of your greed. Is your self-esteem so fragile that you can't be outsmarted once in a while?
Connie laughs. But it's my job, Ibrahim. It's how I make my money. Surely you get that. You're a bright man.
Thank you, says Ibrahim. I once took an IQ test and...
Say... I didn't kill Ron and Bogdan, Connie cuts across. Let's workshop that. Every chancer in Fairhaven would think they can take me on. Do you know my company slogan?
I wasn't even aware you had one, says Ibrahim.
Immediate and brutal retaliation, says Connie.
That makes sense, admits Ibrahim. There are no ethical drug dealers.
In Brighton, there's a fair trade cocaine dealer. He gets all his wraps stamped and everything. Cocaine from family-run farms, no pesticides.
Well, that seems like a start, says Ibrahim. He still threw someone off a multi-story car park for stealing money from him.
Small steps, says Ibrahim. You know, perhaps I could bring Ron in to see you. You might not want to kill him quite so much if you really got to know him.
Ibrahim thinks this through for a moment. Actually, Ron often has the opposite effect on people. Connie considers this.
You're interesting. Would you like a job?
I have a job, says Ibrahim. I'm a psychiatrist.
A proper job, though, says Connie.
No, thank you, says Ibrahim, though it would be fun to work for a crime organization. All that planning, smoky back rooms, men wearing sunglasses indoors.
Then, would you like to be my psychiatrist?
Ibrahim takes this in for a moment. That would actually be a lot of fun. And interesting.
What would you want from a psychiatrist, Connie? What do you think you need?
Connie thinks, learn to exploit weaknesses in my enemies, I guess. How to manipulate juries. How to spot an undercover police officer.
Why I always pick the wrong men.
Well, that's more my sort of thing, says Ibrahim. If someone asks for my help, I always start with one question. Are you happy?
Connie thinks, well, I'm in prison.
But that aside,
I mean, maybe I could be happier, you know. 5%, I'm okay.
I can help with that. 5%, 10, 50, whatever it might be. That's my job. I can't fix you, but I can make you run a little better.
You can't fix me?
Humans can't be fixed, says Ibrahim. We're not lawnmowers. I wish we were.
Might be fun, mightn't it? Said Connie. Unburden all my secrets. What do you charge to buy suits like that?
£60 an hour or less if someone can't afford it.
I'll pay you £200 an hour, says Connie.
No, it's just £60.
If you charge less for someone who can't afford it, then charge more for someone who can. You're a businessman. How often can we meet?
Once a week is best at first, and my schedule is pretty flexible.
Okay, I'll sort it here. They lap this sort of thing up, mental health. And I'll look into Heather Garbutt in the meantime.
Girly chat, what's your star sign? Did you push a car off a cliff?
Thank you.
I shall look forward to speaking with you, says Ibrahim, and seeing if I can persuade you not to murder Ron.
Great, says Connie. Let's do Thursdays.
Actually, says Ibrahim, can we do Wednesdays? Thursdays are the one day I have something on.
Chapter 12. The last time Elizabeth had a bag and blindfold pulled from her head was in 1978. She was in the harshly lit administration block of a Hungarian abattoir and was about to be questioned and tortured by a Russian army general with a chest of blood-stained medals. As events transpired, there was to be no torture, as the general had left his tool bag in the car, and the car had driven off for the evening, so in the end she'd got away with light bruising and an anecdote for dinner parties.
What had he wanted, the general? Elizabeth forgets. Something which no doubt seemed terribly important at the time. She knew people who had died for the blueprints to agricultural machinery. Very few things are so important you would risk your life for them, but all sorts of things are important enough to risk somebody else's life. As her blindfold is removed this time, there is no glare of strip lights, no grinning general, and no blood-smeared filing cabinets. She is in a library, in a soft leather chair. The room is lit by candles, the kind Joyce buys. The man who removed her blindfold and uncuffed her has silently left the room and is out of her sight. Elizabeth looks over to Stephen. He arches an eyebrow at her and says,
well, this is a to-do.
Isn't it? She agrees.
Are you okay?
Right as rain, darling. You just keep your wits about you. I'm out of the old comfort zone here. Bash on the bonds, but no harm done. Probably knocked some sense into me.
You're back all right?
Nothing a Panadol won't fix. Any idea what's afoot here? Anything I can do to help?
Elizabeth shakes her head. This might be one for me. Stephen nods.
I'll look after morale and follow your lead. I don't suppose we'd be in such comfortable chairs if they meant to kill us. You'd know better than me.
I suspect they want to speak to me about something or other,
and decide whether to kill us based on what you have to say.
Possibly. They're both silent for a minute.
I love you, Elizabeth.
Don't be so sentimental, Stephen.
Well, either way, there's never a dull moment,
says Stephen. The door to the library opens, and a very tall, bearded man stoops through the doorway.
Viking, is it?
Stephen whispers to Elizabeth. A man takes his place in an armchair opposite Elizabeth and Stephen. His frame overflows the chair like a teacher sitting on a classroom chair.
So, you are Elizabeth Best?
He asks. That rather depends on who you are, says Elizabeth. Have we met? The man takes something from his pocket.
Do you mind if I vape?
Elizabeth holds out her palms in invitation.
Terribly bad for you, says Stephen. I read a thing. The man nods, takes a drag on his vape, and turns to Stephen. And you must be Stephen. Sorry to drag you into this.
Not a bit of it.
Par for the course with this one. Afraid I didn't catch your name.
The man ignores Stephen's question and returns his attention to Elizabeth.
You have been very busy for an old woman.
What is the accent? Swedish? Elizabeth notices that Stephen is scanning the shelves of the library, eyes opening in wonder from time to time.
Now, Elizabeth, says the Viking, to business. I believe you stole some diamonds.
I see, says Elizabeth. At least she knows where she is now. No ancient history, simply their last little adventure. It felt like she had wrapped the whole thing up with a pretty little bow, but no good deed goes unpunished. Am I to take it that I stole them from you and not from Martin Lomax, after all?
No, no, says the Viking. You stole them from a man named Victor Ilyich.
Victor Ilyich? Elizabeth takes it all back. Ancient history at its very finest. The most dangerous man in the Soviet Union, they used to call him. She has to hand it to herself, however. Whatever jolt of electricity passed through her body at the mention of the name Victor Ilyich, no outside observer would have guessed she had ever heard it before.
And you work for this Victor Ilyich?
The Viking laughs.
Me? No. I work for no one. I am a lone wolf.
We all work for someone, old chap, says Stephen, eyes still scanning the books. He's up to something, God bless him.
Not me, says the Viking. I'm the boss. Oh,
he howls like a wolf for an uncomfortably long time. Elizabeth waits patiently for his howl to end.
So, why am I here? Asks Elizabeth. Not your diamonds, not your boss's diamonds, not your business. I don't care about diamonds. You think I care about 20 million? It's nothing.
The Viking leans forward in his chair, tilts his head, and looks Elizabeth straight in the eyes.
You are here because for some time now I have been looking into the possibility of killing Victor Ilyich.
I see, says Elizabeth.
And it isn't easy, says the Viking.
I'm sure, says Elizabeth. If murder were easy, none of us would survive Christmas.
And so, says the Viking, I want you to kill Victor Ilyich for me.
The Viking leans back, his cards on the table now. Elizabeth is thinking at speed. What has she found herself in the middle of here? Only this morning she had been thinking about traffic cameras and missing bodies. Now she's being threatened by a Viking. Or propositioned, often the same thing in her line of work. Whatever it is, at least it seems that she and Stephen will live to see another day. Let this new game begin, then. She sits back in her chair and clasps her hands together.
I don't kill people, I'm afraid.
The Viking settles back into his chair and smiles.
We both know that's not true, Elizabeth Best.
Elizabeth concedes the point. Here's your problem, though. I've only ever killed people who wanted to kill me. The Viking reaches for a laptop from a side table and gives a broad smile.
Then, we are in luck, because I am shortly to send an email to Viktor Ilyich with two photographs attached. One photograph of you at Fairhaven train station opening a locker and one of you at Fairhaven pier on the day of the shootout, a situation that has caused Viktor Ilyich a great deal of inconvenience.
Banged to rights there, darling, says Stephen. Elizabeth hadn't known that Viktor was involved with Martin Lomax and the business with the diamonds, but it made sense. Viktor was freelance these days.
So, you see, says the Viking, as soon as he receives these photographs, Viktor Ilyich will want to kill you. He will be consumed with revenge. It is very neat. All you need to do now is kill him first.
Kill him yourself, old chap, says Stephen. Look at the size of you.
Much easier for me if somebody else does it, says the Viking. And who better than a former spy, a little old lady, a woman who knows how to kill, and who has just pulled off one of the thefts of the century? Who better, Stephen?
It's cowardly, says Stephen. Never taken the Swedes for cowards.
Elizabeth is mulling, pretending to mull, at least, just arranging her cards in order before playing the first one. She doesn't have a great hand, though she does have an ace. She will have to proceed with care.
Still not for me, I'm afraid, says Elizabeth to the Viking. If I refuse, the worst you can do is kill me, which is a nuisance for you. And honestly, I've had a fairly good run, and this would be a nice room to die in, very cozy.
The Viking smiles.
I think your husband might not agree with that. Perhaps he might like you to stay alive.
Stephen shrugs. We all go at some point, my Viking friend. I'd rather she wasn't killed by a cowardly Swede, but best to bow out doing something decent. I'm sure I'd miss her, but someone else would turn up soon enough. Beautiful spies everywhere you look, falling out of trees. Elizabeth smiles. But what if she really were to die? What then? What then for Stephen? Her heart cracks in two, but her face remains placid, because she knows something the Viking doesn't know.
I think if it's all the same to you, she says, I'm going to take my husband home and forget this conversation ever happened. Put the bags back over our heads. I don't need to know where I am, and I don't have any interest in finding out who you are. I understand your position, and I understand why I'm the perfect woman to kill Viktor Ilyich, but I'm not going to do it, which leaves you with two options. Either you kill me, which would be very messy, an awful lot of admin, probably a lot of heat from MI6 when they realize I vanished, or you simply let us go. No more said about it.
Viktor Ilyich will kill you, though, says the Viking. He will find out where you live. I found out easily enough.
I will take my chances, says Elizabeth. Viktor Ilyich will not kill Elizabeth. She knows that. That's her ace. The Viking has been unlucky here. Elizabeth and Stephen will be home before dawn and will be quite safe, depending on where they are, of course.
So, kill me or let me go. Those are your two options. Which do you choose?
I think I choose option 3, says the Viking.
the option where I send Viktor Ilyich the full photos.
The full photos?
Yes, for sure. The photos with your friend Joyce Meadowcroft by your side, both pictures, both names.
Bit below the belt, says Stephen. Elizabeth still feels safe. Victor won't go after Joyce either. Not if they're in the photo together. A friend of Elizabeth is a friend of Victor.
Victor might not have the heart to kill Joyce, of course, says the Viking. She is more of a civilian, I think. So here's my deal, just as insurance. If Viktor Ilyich isn't dead within 2 weeks, I will kill your friend Joyce.
Chapter 13. The second date was, if anything, even better than the first. They've just been to Brighton to watch a Polish film. Donna hadn't realised there were Polish films, though obviously there must be. In a country that size, someone's going to make a film once in a while. It was an art house cinema, of course it was. It was in Brighton, and that meant you couldn't get proper pick and mix. No chocolate mice, no cola cubes, nothing, just healthy snacks. But they did let you bring wine into the cinema, so Donna supposed it was okay to put up with a handful of unsalted cashew nuts. Also, everyone stayed quiet during the film, which Donna was not at all used to. They took the train from Fairhaven. Donna drank a mojito in a can, and Bogdan drank a large energy drink into which he had mixed a sachet of protein powder. They walked from the station to the cinema, her arm hooked through Bogdan's. At one point, they walked past a house on Trafalgar Street, which Bogdan told her was a crack den, and then past an old forge on London Road, where a Lithuanian was buried. Bogdan would make a very good tour guide for a very specific type of tourist. There were other black people in Brighton, and it was nice to see, though still few enough for a subtle nod to be exchanged as they passed each other. Donna likes Brighton. She could see herself raiding a few crack dens here before her career was out. They talked a little about Bethany Waits and about Heather Garbutt. Donna is putting together a map of all the CCTV cameras in Fairhaven for Chris. It is not an enjoyable job. Now, not only do people in Poland make films, it turns out they make very good ones. Donna had worried it might be a searing portrayal of love and loss across the generations of a remote farming family, and she would have to keep turning to Bogdan and pretending to nod wisely, but not a bit of it. There was a murder. There was fighting. There was a cop in a ripped shirt. It wasn't bad at all. Every few minutes, Bogdan would lean into her, and she readied herself for a kiss, but he was just pointing out occasional inconsistencies in the subtitles. She held his hand. Her red wine slipped down a treat. The gal got the guy, and someone shot down a helicopter. 8 out of 10 would recommend. They went back to his. There wasn't even a question. Where would they have parted, and why? Bogdan is currently in the bathroom, and Donna is frantically rehydrating and trying to recall if she has ever been happier. They had talked a little more about Bethany Waits. Donna had looked into the files on Jack Mason, the businessman, a record as long as a post office queue, charming but dangerous. Talking of which, Bogdan walks back into the room and gets into bed. She puts her arm around him, sleepy and safe. They laugh. God, this feels right. It feels natural and true and unforced. It feels like all those things you read about relationships but assume are lies. Bogdan's mobile phone rings on the bedside table. They both look over at it. It is 2 a.m. Well, here we go, thinks Donna, her reverie immediately broken. All those things are lies. There's another woman, of course. Once again, Donna, nice try. There is always something. She is suddenly not so sleepy and not so safe. Bogdan looks at the number, then back at Donna. I have to take this. I'm sorry. Donna shrugs. She had been planning to stay until morning, but now she starts scanning for her clothes.
Chapter 14. Elizabeth and Stephen have been dropped by the side of a small road in a big wood. The moon is high and full, and pale light zigzags through winter's bare branches above them.
"You gave quite the start when he mentioned Victor Ilyich," says Stephen.
"I gave a start? I thought I covered it pretty well. Does anything get past you?"
"That's a kind thing to pretend. Old friend, is he, Victor?"
"Old enemy, if anything. KGB head of station in Leningrad, 1980s, says Elizabeth, her breath smoke in the clear air.
"Then upwards and upwards."
One of the folders of Victor in the folder the Viking had given her was a Victor in his prime. Not prime exactly, perhaps. The head was already balding, the thick pebble-lens glasses too big for his face, but young at least. The most recent photo brought the shock of age. Old, lined strands of grey hair clinging to the cliff edges, the glasses still too big, but look behind them, and there he was, Victor. The mischief and intelligence in his eyes, the rival who became her friend, the enemy who became her lover? Had they? Elizabeth doesn't recall, but she wouldn't put it past herself. Victor will look at her photograph in the same way, she is sure. Who is this old woman? Elizabeth's phone is dead, and Stephen doesn't have his, so on they walk.
"Without speaking out of turn," says Stephen, "you have a look that says you don't much want to kill him."
"No, I don't," says Elizabeth.
"And do you imagine he will try to kill you?"
"Goodness, no. He'll take one look at the photograph and roar with laughter."
They listen to the owls talk for a while and hold each other close for warmth as they walk. How often do you walk down a new road with an old lover? Elizabeth looks at the moon and at her husband and thinks to herself that this is an unusual time to feel happy.
"But if you don't kill him," says Stephen, "then our Viking friend will kill Joyce."
That's where we find ourselves.
This takes the edge off her mood somewhat.
"Hell of a choice. And as yet, we have no idea who this Viking is."
"Not yet we don't," agrees Elizabeth, as she spies a public phone box on the roadside ahead. "But first things first, we need to get you home. I don't suppose you have 20 pence? Stephen fishes in his pocket and hands Elizabeth a coin.
"It's the middle of the night, dear, don't forget. Everyone will be asleep."
Elizabeth dials the number she knows by heart. She knows all her important numbers by heart. It must be 2 a.m., but the phone is answered before the first ring is completed.
"Hello, Bogdan," says Elizabeth.
"Hello, Elizabeth," says Bogdan. "What do you need?"
"A little help," says Elizabeth. "Right away, if possible."
"Okay, are you at home?"
"Bogdan, I hear a noise in the background. Is somebody there?"
"Is the TV?"
"Well, it isn't the TV, but let's not argue about it now. I'm in a public phone box. I have no idea where, but the number is 01785-547-541. I wonder if you could possibly find out where that is, and then possibly also come and get me."
She hears the sound of a laptop being opened.
"Where is Stephen? You need me to see him?"
"He's with me, dear." Elizabeth puts the receiver to Stephen's mouth.
"Hello, old chap," says Stephen. "Sorry to be a nuisance. A right pair of waifs and strays you have on your hands." "Is no problem," says Bogdan. "Put me back to Elizabeth."
Elizabeth gets back in the call.
"Okay, you're in Staffordshire," says Bogdan. "You heard of Staffordshire?"
"Of course I've heard of Staffordshire," says Elizabeth. "Any chance you could head up? It's very cold."
"Already dressing," says Bogdan.
"Thank you. Any clue how long it will take you?"
Bogdan goes quiet for a moment.
"Google says 3 hours and 45 minutes, so I will be there in 2 hours and 38 minutes.
"I'm almost sure I can hear someone else there, Bogdan."
"It's the sat-nav,"
says Bogdan. You hold tight, and I get there as soon as I can. Do you need me to bring you anything?
Elizabeth thinks for a moment. Viktor Ilyich, the Viking. Joyce, is a plan forming? She believes it may well be. Yes, please, dear, she says. Could you bring me a flask of tea and a gun?
Chapter 15. Mike Waghorn sits in a leather swivel chair in a darkened edit suite. He holds a pen like the cigarette he would dearly love to smoke. But you can't smoke now. Everyone has an HD television. It is very aging. There is a row of television monitors in front of him, and in front of the monitors, a control panel that wouldn't look out of place on an Airbus 380. Mike has recently flown in an Airbus 380 simulator on a corporate away day he hosted for Delta Airlines at Gatwick. He crashed it into the Adriatic, trying to show off. The face of Bethany Waits fills the screens in front of him. Mike is watching the tribute show he has hosted with Fiona Clements. Fiona with her game shows, her adverts, her magazine front covers. She has recently brought out her own diet book. But look at the two of them on screen in 2013. Mike Waghorn, the famous one, Fiona Clemens, the producer, over-promoted to presenter. Mike hadn't thought she would last. Fiona was no fan of Bethany, that was for sure, and vice versa, to be fair. Huge rows the two of them would have. Mike has thought about this a few times over the years. Could Fiona have killed Bethany? It is an absurd thought. But Bethany's death had given Fiona her big break, so who knew? Television was a cutthroat business at the best of times. He had looked further back in his texts after the other night. Bethany had been receiving anonymous notes at work. Just leave. No one wants you here. We are all laughing at you. Schoolyard stuff, really. But perhaps not. Were they from Fiona? And if not, who were they from? There are clips from Bethany's time on Southeast Tonight. It's mainly action shots, the type of stuff that looks good in montages. Bethany Waits on Kent's largest roller coaster. Tom Jones flirting with Bethany Waits backstage at the Brighton Centre. Bethany Waits at the top of a Dubai skyscraper interviewing a Faversham woman who had made a fortune in plastic surgery. Bethany Waits being pushed into a swimming pool by a group of school kids from Deal. But the real memories are never the ones that make the highlights real. The real memories were of quiet afternoons watching Bethany work, the skill with which she found and told stories, the small jokes, the private looks, the squeeze of the hand every evening when they were 5 seconds to air, every day. Anything from the canteen, Mike? No thanks, Beth. My body's a temple. The Twix she would then bring him back. Not roller coasters, not skyscrapers, just the accumulation of small moments that turn acquaintance into friendship. Mike finds it hard to cry because he started having Botox treatments before they really got the hang of them, and his tear ducts are blocked. But he knows the tears are there, and he welcomes them. The tears only exist because Bethany existed. Can he really trust this Thursday murder club? Mike has the peculiar sensation that he is being manipulated, but in such an enjoyable way that perhaps he will stay on the ride for now, see exactly what they're capable of. He freezes the picture in front of him, Bethany's face. It's not a smile or a laugh. He freezes it on a look of calm determination, eyes staring directly into his. He checks the code on screen and sees this is a week before Bethany died. When you look backwards, everything is inevitable. Looking at her face, Mike knows that 1 week later, Bethany would be dead. Mike leans forward and looks into those eyes. Did they know? He could swear now that they did. What on earth had she got herself into? The edit door opens. Thought I might find you here, says Pauline, walking in with two cups of tea.
Just wanted to remind myself, says Mike, that Bethany was a real person and not just a story. Pauline nods. I know you loved her. She could have done all sorts, couldn't she? Says Mike. So full of ambition, full of ideas. Would have left us behind, wouldn't she? Says Pauline. You'd hope so, says Mike. Do you remember those notes she was getting? No one wants you here, on her desk, on her windscreen, all of that. Pauline shakes her head. Made you a cuppa. Thanks, says Mike. What do you think happened, though? I mean, really happened. Pauline puts a hand on his. You know you might never find out, Mike. You know you have to prepare yourself for that. Mike looks at Bethany's face on his screen once more, looks into those eyes. He'll find out, all right. Pauline opens her bag. Let's watch some more together, shall we? Mike nods. Pauline pulls a Twix out of a bag and puts it next to his cup of tea. Chapter 16. Remand prisoners at Darwell Prison are often kept in their cells for up to 23 hours a day. Connie Johnson reflects on how inhumane and unproductive that is as she walks past all the locked cell doors on her evening stroll. One of the warders doffs his cap to her as she makes her way along the steel walkway.